Didn't Even See the Dust by Powderpuff. Fandom Stargate Atlantis. Relationship Taylor Amargan, Elizabeth Weir. Rating Teens and Up. Red Bite Started with Alex. Cover art by Cassiope 25. Author's tags include: yes, this is a deeply whitewashed and idealistic view of the colonization of the Canadian West, not even slightly historically accurate. The prairie was beautiful. That was Elizabeth's first thought as she stared out from the train car. The sky went on for what seemed like forever, a blue and white blanket over the green-yellow of the virgin fescue prairie, tops of the grasses and fronds weaving in the wind, nearly glowing in the bright summer sunshine. So different than the brown stonework and frequently grey skies of Burlington, a different kind of beauty from the shores of Lake Ontario, where she had lived her whole life. Quieter too, or at least a different cacophony of sound than home displayed. Former home. The car's sole occupant, Elizabeth felt no shame in gawking out the window like a child, lost in the imaginings of her new life. She had never been this far west. Athos was merely a name, brought by an old friend of her father's, populated by a handful of people who didn't care much about what you did, so long as you minded your business and let them mind theirs. No, Athos was more than happy to welcome newcomers, providing the newcomer in question understood the rules. Elizabeth was good at understanding rules, and when to bend them. She glanced again at the letter in her hand, the one that transferred ownership of the Athos Saloon and Boarding House and unofficial post office, from Mr. Hallingwells of Athos, District of Alberta, to Miss Elizabeth Weir of Burlington, Ontario, for the price of $200 Canadian. The train continued to rumble down the track, and Elizabeth dreamed. Elizabeth's first impression of Athos was of green and gold. The summer sun was glittering against the bright blue and scattered clouds of the sky, and a recent sunshower had dusted the landscape with rain. The river the train had passed was low and wide. Elizabeth was beginning to realise that a summer in Athos was a drier, windier thing than it was in Burlington. Dustier too, but a different kind than the ash and smoke of an industrial city. The air was sweeter, no chemical slickness burned under her tongue when she stepped onto the wind-kissed platform. Halling was there to greet her at the train station. He was polite and carried her luggage for her, and regaled her with stories about the townspeople as they walked to her new home. There weren't that many. A few farmers, the shopkeeper, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Constable, two gunsmiths, a schoolteacher, a doctor and a blacksmith. And yourself, of course. In all, there was a permanent population of 50 people, although the smithies were outside of the town in case of fire. Most of us were born and raised here, not too many strays. And some people come back, like our tailor. She went off to be a soldier, came back home with Dex and the constable, settled down to be a blacksmith like her old mum. And Rodney, there's a lad I never expected to see again, not after his sister's wedding. You'll meet them all as you go along. Now, here's your room. You've had a journey right enough, you'll be wanting a rest. You just come down when you're ready, and the missus will get you supper. Getting settled into Athos was easier than Elizabeth had expected. Everyone was reasonably friendly, even the somewhat caustic Dr. McKay, who was one of the gunsmiths and came into town once a week to buy food from Chuck Campbell, grumble at Dr. Beckett, and argue, flirt, with Sheriff Shepherd. Halling's eldest grandchild, Jinto, was more than willing to run errands for her, and Dr. Zelenka stopped by weekly to grab both his and McKay's mail and the town gossip. She was rarely alone. The saloon was the main hub of the town, and most of the residents could be found there in the evening. The only person she had never met was the blacksmith, Amargan. She mentioned this as an aside to Constable Shepherd. "Call me John," he had winked, refined southern charm smothered in rural affectation. Elizabeth knew the type and was amused and suspicious in equal amounts. "Taylor's been out of town. Had to go up to the fort to settle a bill. She ought to be home within the month, so long as the train stays on time." John grinned. "Finest woman you'll ever meet. Can't cook worth a damn, but she's the best shot this side of the Rockies. Better than our Dex, even." Ronan Dex, the town schoolteacher, grunted in assent. Ronan didn't talk very much, as a rule. John looked like he was about to say more, but young Wex chose that moment to rush in, hollering about how old Everett's cow had broken out again, and John and Ronan went to help wrestle the beast back home. That was another thing about Athos. Although the Mounties had supplied the area with their presence, John's main job seemed to largely consist of animal wrangling. There was a prison, ostensibly. To Elizabeth's knowledge, since it had been built, it had held a farrowing pig, 3 chickens, a sickly bison, and never an actual person. Well, save once, Halling had said, his voice grim. A Castus Collier was in there once upon a time, when we had old Constable Sumner. The worst kind of thief he is. Doesn't much care who he hurts, so long as he gets what he wants. Catching him was a feather in Sumner's cap right enough, but we didn't realise Collier had gone and found himself a gang. He shook his head sadly. They broke Collier out of prison and shot Sumner while he slept, like he was a dog gone rabid. Last we heard, he was down in the States. Some folks say he's dead, but I won't trust him till I see his body right enough. But never mind, never mind. I'm sure he won't be seen up in these parts any time soon. Here now, let me go over the bookkeeping with you. Some of these figures might be a bit opaque if you aren't familiar with my chicken scratch. As interested as she was in Taylor Amargan and Acastus Collier, Elizabeth acknowledged that the bookkeeping was more important, so she put aside her questions and returned to her accounting. In point of fact, Elizabeth put Taylor aside so thoroughly that she was completely blindsided the day she looked up to Astoft, excuse me, and jumped out of her skin, nearly dropping the glass she was washing. The woman in front of her was slight and whip-lean. There were old scars on her well-muscled forearms, and the sheen of sweat on her face had turned the dusting of carbon on her cheeks shiny. "Yes, you must be Taylor Amargan. Elizabeth Weir, it's nice to finally meet you." Elizabeth extended her hand, which was grasped firmly in response. Taylor, she noted somewhat absently, had strangely delicate, long-fingered hands, more appropriate for a jeweller than a blacksmith. But the firm calluses on her fingers and shine of old burns on her bare bicep proved her profession. Taylor smiled with a flash of white teeth. "I see rumour has travelled faster than my horse. Yes, I am Taylor. You must forgive me for frightening you. I did not mean to sneak so." Elizabeth hastened to reassure her that no apology was necessary, that Elizabeth should have been paying attention. "It's rare that someone comes in this time of day, but it isn't unheard of." She offered her a drink, resisting the urge to watch, as Taylor tipped the glass back, long brown throat working as she swallowed the proffered whisky in one unceasing pull, wiping her mouth with a hand. "I thank you. I got in the day before yesterday. I meant to introduce myself earlier, but young Wex's horse threw a shoe and needed tending to." "So you're also the town farrier. Must keep you busy." Taylor laughed. "It does indeed, but I like my work. How are you enjoying Athos? I must admit to being quite curious that Halling sold to someone from so far east. We do not get many strangers who stay, only John and Ronan so far." Elizabeth did like Athos and said so, and the discussion moved on a meandering path, from how different it was from Burlington to how fascinated Taylor was by a steel she had seen in Fort Edmonton called Damascus, to laughing over how Carson had recently stumbled over Dr. McKay and John kissing behind the Caldwell barn, and Laura Cadman had subsequently cleaned up from the betting pool, until the shadows had shifted and they realised that it was well into the afternoon. The saloon would soon begin to get busy, and Taylor still had work to do. "I will see you again, Elizabeth," said Taylor, preparing to leave. It sounded like a promise. Summer gently shaded into autumn. The grasses faded into senescence, and the nights slowly crept further and further into day. The unfamiliar birds Halling had named magpies left, and most of the robins. The air was filled with the cries of geese as they made their way to warmer climes. Harvest meant everyone was busy, and the saloon filled up later in the evenings than before, leaving Elizabeth time to get further accustomed to the rhythm of her new life. Athos wasn't so much quieter than the upscale Burlington neighbourhood she had grown up in, but the sounds were different. Trains rumbling by, livestock calls carried on the wind, the shouts of the workers pulling in the harvest. Sometimes, when the wind was just right, Elizabeth could hear the ringing of Taylor's hammer in her forge. She could also see its glow from her bedroom window, and it brought her a strange comfort in the unbroken dark. Occasionally, Elizabeth found herself missing Burlington, the dances, the parties, the political machinations she was so deft at. But there was a joy in the sewing circles and storytelling found in Athos too, and Elizabeth, more skilled in making friends than with a sewing needle, found herself managing neater stitching than she had ever achieved previously, thanks to Charon's patient tutelage. And as she stitched, she listened to Charon's stories, to Halling's folklore, to Milana's cheerful gossip. Laura spoke of funny things that occurred on the farm, how Carson had begun to blush when he saw her, which was promising, and how Evan Lorne, the newly transplanted surveyor, had taken to haunting Atlantia Gunsmith's during the day. "They've taken on a new apprentice," Laura had explained. "Miko, I think her name is. She's from Japan. Goodness knows what brought her all the way out here. I may invite her round. Poor girl's shyer than a wild mare. She'd do well with some company other than those two cranks. She isn't living here, Elizabeth." "No, I suppose they thought it more convenient for her to live there. I hope they aren't mistreating her in any way. She seems very sensitive for the brief time I spoke to her." Taylor shook her head in the corner where she and Ronan were carding wool. "Rodney is very particular about his kitchen and does all the cooking, and Raddock is fussy about the house. I doubt Miss Kusanagi will ever need to pick up a pan or a broom so long as she lives there. She spends much of her time learning the trade. Rodney and Raddock are very impressed with her performance. I gather she is a natural by the way they go on about her." "Well, I still think we all ought to drop by on occasion. Someone needs to make sure those three don't work themselves into the grave." It is in such sewing circles that great things are decided. And Taylor kept coming around, even on non-sewing days. Elizabeth learned not to let her cook, learned how Taylor liked her bacon, learned how to make Saskatoon jelly from Charon so Taylor could put it on her pancakes. She learned how to make the herbal infusion Taylor swore by when Taylor would come in looking a trifle paler than usual. She noticed, too, how John, Ronan and Rodney were always a little bit more considerate during these times, wondered if she would ever know the story there. Elizabeth learned about the stars because they had been Rodney's first, oldest love, and he wanted others to love them too. She often found herself outside with him and some of the other townsfolk as he explained what was above them with a look of wonder, and didn't notice John, who had the same expression when he watched Rodney. And then Taylor would share stories about them, ones told to her by her mother and grandmother, and Elizabeth's breath would catch when she saw the stars reflected in Taylor's eyes. Elizabeth also learned about soil from Ronan, about horses from John, about climate patterns from Raddock, the sorts of things rarely taught to polite young lawyers' daughters, no matter how broad and open-minded their education. In return, she told her friends about politics, about tactics, about facing a social interaction like a battlefield. She played chess with Carson and won. She played chess with John and lost. She played chess with Rodney and won 50% of the time. Elizabeth also learned how to shoot. "You mean you have never been taught to handle a gun?" Taylor had said one day with a tinge of polite shock, like some of her Burlington friends had when Elizabeth had mentioned her plans to uproot her whole life and move across the country. Elizabeth's smile was wry with memory. "It isn't something taught to genteel ladies back east, but you are more than welcome to teach me if my lack of knowledge distresses you." A trifle bold, perhaps, but she judged their friendship strong enough to risk it. Taylor seemed willing, and so Elizabeth began spending an hour every day at the firing range Rodney and Raddock had assembled for testing their stock, with Taylor gently correcting her as needed, and Rodney and Raddock insisting that she try this gun or this other one. How did it feel? Should they market it to polite young ladies in the city, or would this one be better? Elizabeth noted, with some amusement, how Ronan and John would occasionally come to watch, shouting encouragement or critique until Rodney or Raddock came to collect them. Couldn't they see Elizabeth was learning? "Since you clearly don't have enough work to do, come shoot this. It's a prototype, but we think..." And she and Taylor would be left blissfully alone again to finish Elizabeth's lesson. Afterwards, they would retire to Taylor's forge, and Elizabeth would help with various small tasks, and not stare, or at least not stare obviously, as Taylor worked, the glow of the flame accentuating her cheekbones, her lips, the dark of her eyes as the shadows flickered around her. In other times, Elizabeth thought, they would name you a goddess and leave you offerings of gold and rubies dusted with the blood of white stallions. And then Taylor would sneeze or swear and become once again a woman of flesh and blood, and Elizabeth would put away her fancies. Until the next time. Elizabeth stayed busy and happy, and the fact that she would sometimes close her eyes and remember the feeling of Taylor behind her, her hands gentle as she shifted Elizabeth's grip or her stance, well, that was Elizabeth's business. Of course, it wasn't all smooth sailing. Elizabeth had been raised as a lawyer's daughter, etiquette lessons and all, but that did not mean she wasn't awkward in her own way. Her bedside manner especially was seen as a trifle alarming, and Carson banned her from John's bedside entirely after he broke his leg, having tripped over a gopher hole, and she had told him earnestly that it would probably not get infected. Maybe. Carson seemed sure, at least. John had thrown a pillow at her in revenge, and Carson had shooed her out, insisting his patient needed rest, and she left, laughing. A prairie winter is a dry, cold thing. The air bit at Elizabeth's face when she dared go outside, and the snow was lighter and less frequent than she was used to. But the chill did not seep into her bones like it had back home, which meant she did eventually get warm, and there was less of that cold drizzling rain that was the scourge of southern Ontario, before the snow came in earnest and it grew too cold for rain. Athos lacked the winter rain entirely. Instead, the snow that fell was dry and fluffy, easily blown about by the howling prairie wind. Winter was hushed here, most of the birds having left for warmer climes, save a few, sturdy and stubborn chickadees, chattering aggressive sparrows, and others Elizabeth did not know the names of, but classified privately as small, noisy and round. The train grew less frequent as well. Elizabeth found she missed the rumble of it, the shrill whistle as it passed. She found herself lonelier than she was used to late at night, only the candlelight and the stars for company. Memories came thick, and she wondered about Simon more than she used to, more really than she should. Her friends noticed her shift of mood and tried to cheer her up. In return, Elizabeth tried to be cheered. It was better when the sun was shining and her friends were done with work for the day, even if that was only because they worried for her. Taylor would lean against the bar while Ronan told a story about what the children had gotten up to in class. Ronan was a very outdoorsy sort of teacher who didn't hold with children being cooped up in a schoolroom for too long, and Rodney would insist on hearing about what his young niece Maddie was actually learning, and Taylor would scold him good-humouredly for it. Taylor, too, did not hold with children being trapped in classrooms. And Elizabeth would smile and pass around the whiskey and stored up the moments for the lonesome evenings, when her ghosts crowded her bedside. But Carson began to look at her worriedly, and one day pressed a package into her hand with instructions to drink it once a day, lass, and be sure to spend an hour a day out of doors when you can. Concern, Elizabeth noticed, brought his accent out thick. Not for the first time she wondered how a small Alberta hamlet had such a high percentage of foreign-born residents. Regardless, Carson must have mentioned something to the other women of the town as well, because Elizabeth found herself with company in the evening more often than not. If it wasn't Laura, it was Dusty. If it wasn't Dusty, it was Alison, or Anne, or sometimes Jeanie, daughter in tow. But mostly, it was Taylor. "Don't you have the forge to look after?" Elizabeth had asked one day, when Taylor had dropped by, insisting Elizabeth come skating on the river. "I have completed what I need to complete. The rest will keep. Come, it will be good for you to get some air. Let Jinto handle things here." And with a nod at the boy in question, Taylor dragged Elizabeth out into the snow despite her protests. "I haven't been skating in years." "Then it is about time." Taylor was implacable when she really wanted something, and Elizabeth, to tell the truth, was not all that adverse. Taylor had brought her a spare pair of skates to save her boots, so Elizabeth could not even protest on that note. So she went, and found herself grateful for it, because Taylor, graceful as a deer when walking, flew on the ice. It was like watching a dancer. Elizabeth found herself helplessly staring as she spun and twisted, sped and jumped. Laughing after a particularly bold spin, Taylor grabbed Elizabeth's gloved hands and pulled her along, face flushed with exertion. The ice was slippery, and Elizabeth was out of practice. But with Taylor's efforts, she soon began to remember how to glide along without perpetually falling. They skated until well into the afternoon. Then Elizabeth insisted that Taylor come to the saloon to warm up, if nothing else. "The evening rush won't have started yet, and Jinto will be glad of the company. You can try some of the new soup I made." "Very well. I suppose it is quite cold, and my own cooking certainly brings little joy." Taylor smiled, gesturing towards the saloon. "Lead the way." They crunched their way back, where Jinto, through some strange sixth sense, had already prepared a pot of tea for them. The soup, too, was warm for the evening crowd, and Charin had delivered a fresh loaf of bread on her way to the grocer. The resulting meal, split between the three of them, was simple but filling, and all that Elizabeth could hope for after a cold winter day. The evening rush, such as it was, came and went, and Jinto went home to his own bed, but Taylor remained to help Elizabeth clean up, apparently sensing how reluctant Elizabeth was to be alone, without Elizabeth having to say so. Instead, Taylor went upstairs to grab the broom, while Elizabeth began counting the day's earnings. "How about I save you the trouble of counting all of that, and you just hand it to me?" said a voice Elizabeth didn't recognise, and her head snapped up. The man who had spoken was weather-beaten, with a long scar across one cheek. His eyes were steady as they met hers. He also had a gun trained at her chest. Elizabeth straightened and remembered every deportment lesson her tutors had insisted that she learn. "Thank you, Mother." "I'm sure that won't be necessary. If you are hungry, I'm more than willing to provide you food and shelter for the night." "Come on, Taylor, the broom is right where it always is." "You appear to have misunderstood me. The money or your life, now." Elizabeth nodded once and began removing the bills and coins from the drawer, placing them in neat stacks on the counter. "I really wish you wouldn't do this." "I'm sure you do. However, what you wish is not my concern." The man began to grab the money one-handed, shoving them into his side pouch. "You should not live alone, Miss Weir. Do not look so surprised. I'm not a fool. I know how to pick my targets." "But not well," said Taylor behind him. "You are very brave to show your face here again, Collier." "Ah, Miss Amargan." Collier's voice sent a chill down Elizabeth's spine as he turned. His gun was still aimed at Elizabeth. "Here to rescue the poor defenceless innkeeper, I see. Unfortunately, you are only one, while I have four." He gave a sudden sharp whistle, and Elizabeth willed herself not to jump, eyes flickering around the bar, looking frantically for some kind of weapon she could use to defend herself. They all waited, still, but there was no answering noise against the rattle of the wind. Collier's eyes narrowed. Taylor grinned then, slightly feral. "Unfortunately, you appear to be incorrect. Your people will not be able to assist you. Perhaps you should instruct them not to be so visible from an upstairs window, and therefore not be easy targets for a thrown bucket. And now I think it is time for you to lower your weapon." Collier was lightning quick, but Taylor was a flash of movement as he turned to shoot, and before he had even rotated fully, she had the broken broom handle pressed against his throat. "You will drop the gun." The metal hit the floor with a thud. "Good. Elizabeth, go get help, and ask someone to fetch John, quickly now." Elizabeth hesitated for a moment. What if this Collier got free, but realised that anyone else would be a greater help than herself just now? She nodded, delicately picking up the gun and handing it to Taylor before she bolted out the door and into the winter night, yelling for help. It was Ronan who heard her first, poking his head out of his front door to see what the matter was. Elizabeth only had time to gasp out, "Collier!" before he was yelling for Melena to get John, quick as she could, and insisting Elizabeth stay there while the matter was settled. Elizabeth was rattled enough that it seemed like a sound plan. Melena ushered her into the kitchen with an, "It's freezing, you'll catch your death running about in naught but your dress," and took the time to shove a teacup in her hand that smelled mostly like tea-flavoured whisky before bolting out the door. Elizabeth heard the clatter of horses' hooves, looked at the teacup, and promptly threw the whole thing back. The next morning found Elizabeth ensconced in her kitchen along with John and Taylor. She was tired. Although the Dexa's spare bed was as comfortable as she could have wished, she couldn't help but stare up into the dark for most of the night, body shaking as the adrenaline bled out of her system.
"Well, it's Collier and his crew right enough. Well done, ladies."
John's grin was boyish, but there was something in his eye that Elizabeth couldn't read and decided right then that she never wanted to try. "They'll be under 24-hour guard until the folks up at the fort come to get them. And until then, Taylor, I'd be much obliged if you could stay here with Elizabeth. I don't want anyone to be alone, not while we've got those bastards in lockup. And now I'd best go tell Rodney all's well. Expect him by today, and don't you mind his fuss. I'll warn you, I think he intends to grumble about the mail being late, as an excuse to bring soup by." He tipped his hat politely and left, whistling in the crisp winter dawn. Elizabeth stared after him. There is something odd about that man. Taylor's answering smile was sardonic. "John is a good friend, but I must agree that I find him puzzling at times. Certainly not the sort of man I ever thought Rodney would get involved with. But they are happy, and that is all that matters." She looked at Elizabeth, and her smile changed. When she spoke, her voice was soft. "And you, Elizabeth, are you happy here? I know last night must have been very frightening for you, and I'm sorry for it." Elizabeth looked at Taylor then and took a deep breath. She had faced down a man with a gun last night. She could do this. "I am happy, yes. You saved me last night. There is no need to be sorry." Carefully, she slipped her hand over Taylor's and caught her clear-eyed gaze. "Taylor, may I?" "Yes," Taylor said gently, and they kissed then over Elizabeth's worn kitchen table as bright winter sunshine began to diffuse through the window. Somewhere a robin sang.
Spring was slow to come that year. Not so late as to cause alarm, but late enough that there seemed to be a permanent sludge of snow and mud on Elizabeth's floor, no matter how often she washed it and yelled at people to clean their boots before they came in. More than once she found herself resisting the impulse to write to Mrs. Hufflestone, her old housekeeper, and beg her to come to Athos and help. No one kept a clean house like Mrs. Hufflestone, she mentioned despondently to Taylor one drizzly evening, after a day filled with dirty slush and broken glassware. Taylor arched an eyebrow. "Alone?" she inquired, stretching languorously against the bedsheets, naked arms spread above her head, bare feet arching. The firelight danced, and Elizabeth, not for the first time, found herself studying the play of the light against Taylor's skin, the way it brought out the gold undertones of her hair, and wondering if Evan could paint her just like this, realizing she didn't want anyone else to see Taylor this way. "No, no, we had maids as well. She would never agree at any rate. I think she loved me in her own way, but she's very proper. I think Athos would send her into hysterics." "Then perhaps it would be best for you to request her advice, instead of insisting she travel here. It is too late for this year, I fear, but there is always the next. I am afraid you will be fighting slushy floors for the rest of your life, dear heart." Elizabeth acknowledged the veracity of this statement with a resigned half-smile, turning from Taylor to begin the process of banking the still necessary fire. "I'm sure worse things happen at sea, but it is a trial." Fire-banked, she reached for her nightdress. It had been a long day, and she yearned for sleep. "Well, it will be young Jinto's trial tomorrow. I was thinking we could ride out to the ravine instead of up the hill. It is longer, but I find it a more pleasant ride this season." Taylor shifted so Elizabeth could join her. "Unless you are hesitant to leave him alone for so long." Elizabeth was not. Jinto was a steady lad, and she was comfortable leaving him for much of the day, so long as she was home by evening, and so it was agreed. Sleep came quickly. It had been a long day at both saloon and forge, and neither felt up to prolonging it any further. And they had 100 tomorrows of the same, and the thought allowed Elizabeth to fall asleep with a smile. The End.